Okay, just by way of review, we're going to talk very quickly about macro and microevolution again. So macroevolution, that's large-scale evolutionary changes. This is what we would think of when we're thinking of primates evolving into humans, or one organism over the course of millions of years evolving into something that really doesn't look anything like what it came from. Microevolution, on the other hand, this is actually observable in nature. This is small-scale genetic changes within a species that happens over time. And then some of the, not necessarily biblical examples of microevolution, but some biblical examples of how the earth as a whole, that just the natural world changes. We used examples from Genesis 7, which is the biblical account of the flood. And so the amount of animals that were killed, all of the plants that would have been killed, and then thinking about how that changed for the path of Earth's I suppose biological future, just because of the massive event. We know that there are massive events that cause changes that then different species of plants and animals have to adapt to. And we also know that they have the ability to do that because a lot of that information, that adaptable information, it's in their DNA. So it's already present. It's not as though it evolves. It just is something that may not necessarily come out right away. Right? This is what we talk about when we talk about natural selection. Right? So if there is a couple different species that are classified as prey to a predator, one species in a certain environmental condition may be a little bit better equipped to hide itself, to run away, etc. So the faster pronghorn is going to be a little bit better at running away from the pack of coyotes than would the slower pronghorn. So then the faster pronghorn survives and is able to pass down its genetic DNA, whereas the slower one may not. Right? So it's just issues like that we say, again, they're observable. We know that there are changes that species have to adapt to. And I think what's impressive is that, again, all of that is inside our DNA that allows us to then pass on these traits that may show themselves. So my two boys may look actually a lot like maybe a great-grandparent because that trait has come about. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's somewhere inside of my boys that all of a sudden just kind of activated this gene. It was already there. Okay? For animals, on the other hand, when you're talking about species that are better equipped to survive in certain circumstances, and we all know that there is a such thing as climate change, just not in the way that it's advertised, right? There was a time period where the Earth's temperature was very low. There's a time where the Earth's temperature was quite a bit higher on average. Okay? Species have to adapt to that, and some branches of those species may die out as a result. Hosea 4:3 talks about what could be, I think, without stretching it too much, talking about some extinction. So in that passage, God is judging the land and saying that the fish are going to be removed from it, the plants and the animals are going to be removed, And the land is going to suffer because of the sin of the children of Israel. So that sounds to me like it could have some extinction events involved because God is judging the land, and now some of those species may be able to withstand that new change, but some may not. Okay? So at least for that immediate point, geographically speaking, there's going to be a level of extinction that takes place. Okay? And it might be localized, but it's still, the Bible still obviously allows for that. Here are some specific examples of both macro and microevolution. So interestingly enough, the first thing that's under the microevolution side of the table is something that Darwin himself observed and led to, at least partially speaking, his development of the theory of evolution on a macro scale. Right, so the changes in beak size in finches, this is observed by Darwin. So some finches have a different size, and it allows them to forage differently than finches that have a certain other beak size, just kind of depending on where they live. And the species is extremely similar, except for these genetic traits that seem to come out. So the finches that have larger beaks, it allows them to forage for the food that's available in their specific location, whereas finches that are in a different location that have to forage for other things, their smaller beak size equips them a little bit better for that. And I don't think anyone is going to say, wow, that's too far of a stretch. That means you're an evolutionist. No, I mean, it just kind of makes sense, right? The trait that allows that finch to eat is the trait that's going to get passed on. Antibiotic resistance in bacteria, some bacteria can build up a resistance to certain antibiotics. That doesn't mean that the bacteria is evolving. Actually, inside the genetic information for that bacteria is its ability to resist antibiotics. It's just that unless it's exposed to the antibiotics, you're not going to see that genetic information come out and show itself. Okay? Color variations in moths, we talked about how interesting that study was. We have white moths that are against white bark on the trees, then the Industrial Revolution comes about, all this pollution, the bark on the tree becomes black, and now all of a sudden you have these black moths. Does that mean that they're also covered in all the soot? No, they're actually black moths. So now all of these white moths are gone. Why? Because they couldn't hide themselves against the dark bark that was on those trees anymore, and they were eaten by the birds. Whereas the black moths, which would be a recessive gene prior to the Industrial Revolution, now becomes the dominant gene because they can hide themselves and they fit in better against that backdrop. So it's fascinating to think about, and it's documented, it's observed, okay? Canine breeds, all the different breeds of dogs, some of those because of human intervention, right? Specific breeds for specific purposes, cattle herding, hunting, things like that. But then you have breeds of wolves. There's different types of wolves depending on which part of North America you're in. And does that mean that that species evolved? No, it just means that that genetic information for that specific wolf benefited it a little bit better than would maybe a wolf that was released and hunting people's cattle up in the Rocky Mountains. Macroevolution, that's the big stuff. That's fish to amphibians, reptiles to birds, primates to humans. That's something that has actually never been observed, and like we're going to talk about today, has significant problems once you actually look at the genetic issues. So I don't mean too much today to get into the weeds, so to speak, and get very specific, but I am going to get specific. So I need you all to stay with me. I think it's extremely important to go through the specific issues with macroevolution, because it's actually illogical on a level that I think once you understand its illogic nature, you will, I think it'll strengthen your faith. So let's talk about this picture again. This was from two slides previous. This is not showing from left to right an evolutionary supposition. And what this is showing is actually different species of primates, and then on the far right of the screen is the skeleton of a human or of man, as it's labeled here. Okay. But can we see some similarities in the skeletal construction of the primates and the human? You can see the rib cages, even the jaw structure, the skull. You'll notice that each of these species that's on the diagram here, they have two bones in their forearm, which is kind of interesting. Of course, there's that opposable thumb, which is unique to primates and to humans, that allow them to grab things a lot easier. So my question here is it so difficult to believe that if you're given millions of years, which, like I said before, I was talking about billions, but even millions of years is almost an inconceivable amount of time. If you had millions of years, does it seem difficult to believe that organisms might have macroevolved into new organisms by way of microevolution? So if microevolution, all the examples we talked about before, if that was just allowed to run its course over millions and millions of years, could we have, especially when you're looking at this diagram of the similarities of these species, could we have micro-evolved over that amount of time into the figure that you see on the far right? Okay. And as you're looking at this picture, and you're thinking about the observable truth that is microevolution, all of those examples we talked about, you may think, well, I suppose if we're going to be entirely objective here, and we're going to start with the premise that the Earth is hundreds of millions of years old, maybe you, like me, would say, it seems on its face somewhat conceivable, right? Because we can see those changes in things like beak size of finches, and maybe there are some genetic mutations that would be a little bit more extreme, okay? And I would argue that the beak sizes is not a mutation, but maybe there would be mutations, or maybe there would be DNA variations that may just come out over those millions and millions of years, and now that leads to all of the different species that we have, and maybe humans too. Okay? And again, I'm just trying to be as entirely objective as possible, just for the sake of the argument. Okay? But we right away into some issues. I'm going to call this, the argument is itself is not was not developed by me, but I'm going to name it some, I don't know who else came up with it or what they named it. I'm going to call it the Henry Ford argument. Okay? The reason I'm calling it the Henry Ford argument is because Henry Ford was responsible for a lot of different models of vehicles throughout his time with Ford Motor Company. Okay? And everybody can recognize the Model T, but there was all kinds of different models. There was Model A, there was Model B, there was Model S. If you were to line all of those vehicles up that Henry Ford designed and helped to, at least the first couple models, helped to build, would you find some general similarities between those models? Absolutely. Because they have the same designer, right? Henry Ford is going, there's going to be some continuity in what he develops. So if you look again at this picture and say, there are some similarities there that are just very, very difficult to explain. Not necessarily, because there is observable similarities anytime anyone designs anything. Okay? When I was young and enjoyed drawing cars, and it wasn't necessarily cars that were in existence, but there were certain similarities in the things that I was designing. They would all have common features, be sleek, aerodynamic, loud, large engines, because I'm an Unruh and that's how we like our cars. Okay? But those similarities, does that mean that my, that those designs somehow evolved from one to the other? There are some slight evolution. As I grew older, there were some details that would possibly come out. And certainly there was an evolution. You know, if you look at the timeline of Henry Ford's vehicles, did his models evolve as they went on in the basic sense of the word? Yes. But I think the similarities itself doesn't mean that those things evolved by themselves. And it also gives us a very visual example of how if you have a common designer, there's going to be similarities that you're going to be able to find. Right? And that doesn't necessarily prove the theory of evolution. So there's also something that we have to talk about when we're talking about extinct species versus missing links. Okay? Does anyone know, just commonly speaking, what is a missing link within the theory of evolution? Janet up here.
It would basically be a cross between something that was then and something that is now. And the primates, maybe something that was more upright and had shorter arms, but not quite human.
Yeah. So there are distinct differences between the species that are up on the screen right now and the one that's on the far right, which is the skeleton of a man. Okay.
Yeah, just a comment, because I guess I'm getting old enough to point this out. When I was a young Christian, and the theory of evolution in the last 30 years has really, they've changed that. Maybe that's where you're
evolved.
With this. Every time science has disproved the Homo sapiens sapien, the missing link,
yep,
bone, then they just change the whole theory and start all over.
Mm-hmm.
And, it takes more faith to believe in that type of unscientific process where, hey, if we lose, we're just going to start all over.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that the picture here may, in this generation, that may be the pitcher they're saturated with. But mm-hmm. if you go back to the 60s and 70s and you see the Homo sapien, the different picture, they were not ever able with science to, you know, confirm that missing link. So yep. anyway.
Yeah, and the point that I'm trying to make is even the species that you see on the screen that look similar, evolution, if it happens slowly over time, that leads to a macroevolution. Because, I mean, just look at the difference between, well, just the gorilla and the man, because they're side by side. There are some similarities in the skeletal structure, but there has to be something that's in between that, where the gorilla in its hunched over form is now slowly becoming more upright. And that missing link that we're talking about is, where are all of the species that were in between this point and this point? And there's been all kinds of fraudulent discoveries, like the Nebraska man, that have come out and they've said, we found a missing link. Well, even if you had found something like that, you've only found one. We're talking about millions of years, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these organisms that are all simultaneously evolving. So how is it that we do not have in the fossil record all of these in-between species? Because there's a big difference between finding an extinct species and a missing link. Okay? Lots of species have become extinct since the beginning of time. We're not finding species of those extinct ones that are these missing links. Okay? So that's the difference that causes, just on its surface, that's one of the most basic arguments that people bring up. Where are these missing links? Okay? Evolutionists, by this point, like you were referring to, they've evolved their argument to answer for that. And of course, they, in their infinite wisdom, have just thrown it away. Well, you can't have the missing links argument. We've solved that. Well, it's still an issue. So I want to play a video. It's a very brief video. How many of you are familiar, just by raised hand, with Richard Dawkins? He's a very, very prominent evolutionist and atheist. He's a very highly intelligent man. He knows a lot about biology. He knows a lot about physics. He was asked if he could give, while he's giving this lecture, there's a question and answer time, and one of the questions was, can you give one fact that in your mind refutes creation? So this person who is very, very vocal about disagreeing with creation, he mocks, and you'll see in this video, he does it, he mocks Christians for their belief in creation. Okay? You're going to ask the most, let's just say the most intelligent, one of the most intelligent atheists that's on the earth right now, one fact to refute creation. Again, this kind of gets you a little bit nervous, right? What is he going to say? That's going to be the one thing that this super intelligent man's going to say. It refutes everything that you believe. So I'm going to play this video, and you can see based on my history here that I have children and a wife that is an Eagles fan. So... Oh, okay. Giving us issues again. Did it disconnect when I backed out of the... Oh, okay. I don't know why it would go back to that screen, though, because it should still give the background. Let me try to open it back up. I anticipated that there might be issues, so I actually wrote down the entire quote. So if it reconnects... Yeah, it looks like it's going to reconnect. I don't know why it does that, but at any rate, here's what Richard Dawkins said in response to that. And he's British, so he already sounds condescending. I'm not going to read it in a British accent. I could, because I would sound very condescending too. But this is the core of his answers. He says, the pattern of resemblances that you see when you compare the genes using modern DNA techniques, actually looking at the letter by letter correspondences between genes. So I understand that that's not a complete sentence, the way that it reads, it's a fragment, But that's his one fact. It's the pattern of resemblances that you see when you compare the genes, etc. Okay. Then he continues, compare the genes of any pair of animals you like, any pair of plants, and they fall into a perfect hierarchy, a perfect family tree. Based on that quote, could you rephrase that quote into maybe a constructive argument that he's trying to make? So what is, in essence, what is the argument that Richard Dawkins is making? He's saying that the one thing that refutes creation is what? There's a pattern, okay? So he's saying that this pattern disproves creation. I did this exercise with my students, right? Here's a big, long quote. Now condense it. What is he saying? If you had to just name this one fact, you had to title it, what was it? What's the one thing? Yeah?
Genetic code.
Okay, yep. Relationships in genes themselves, okay? So he's actually getting into the analysis of DNA using the modern DNA techniques, and he's looking at the correspondence of the DNA across any pair of animals and any pair of plants. He's saying, look at all of the similarities in this genetic information across the board. How could they not be related? Is that a pretty good argument? I mean, it's a pretty strong argument in the sense that what he believes is that if you just started with a simple genetic structure, right, and then if evolution is true, it changed over time, and everything that we see came from a common ancestor, so to speak, then there would be all of that genetic similarities that you would find. Now, I still think, in this case, that the Henry Ford argument probably still would have at least a little bit of an ability to refute that, because there's going to be a lot of genetic similarities simply because DNA is everywhere. In every living thing, there is DNA. And there's also common characteristics. Okay? And this is where the issue actually starts. Okay, is the common characteristics. We're going to look a little bit more like that. But his proof of evolution, essentially, and he uses this word twice, so I'm not putting words in his mouth. His assumptions and his proof of evolution is perfection, is that they fall into a perfect hierarchy, and they, meaning the genes, perfect hierarchy, a perfect family tree. That's the support of evolution, is perfection. How interesting. Okay? Because there's multiple laws of nature, the second law of thermodynamics, that does not allow for that type of belief anyway. To say that you start from one thing and it perfects itself over time, in the scientific world, and I'm not just talking about biology, but in any instance, have we ever observed that happening? Where something starts from something that's primitive and then perfects itself just over the course of millions of years by the laws of nature? Never been observed. How interesting that that's his refutation of creationism, is perfection. Okay. So then he makes fun of creationists because they're closed-minded to evidence that contradicts their claim. So my question to him is, how much evidence against evolution has Dawkins closed his mind to? Because I can say from personal experience and just people that I've talked to who are creationists, he's right. There are some Christians who just will not hear anything. They're not really interested in researching. And it's almost because, and I can't speak for them, but it's almost because they're afraid of what the conversation may lead to and the answers they may not have. So we're just not even going to push the subject of evolution with somebody like Richard Dawkins or any other atheist, Sam Harris, whoever you want to name. We're not even going to talk to them because I'm afraid that you're going to come up with something that I may not have an answer to. And so we just close our mind to everything. Evidence for the Big Bang, oh, the Big Bang's stupid. That never happened. There's no evidence for it at all. Well, as we've seen, there actually is some pretty strong evidence of that. But you're just going to completely close your mind to all of that evidence because you think that it disproves creationism. But if you look a little bit closer, are you sure that that's actually what it's doing? Okay. My argument, though, is somebody who is in such a, he's so comfortable with his position as an evolutionist that he's comfortable with ridiculing people who are creationists. Is he closing his mind? Let's talk about some stuff that causes issues with what he says. Genetic gaps. Okay. Genetic gaps, let's talk about underneath that category of genetic gaps, orphan genes. Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
The pattern theory is fascinating to me because, of course, I started off a chemical engineer and then went to mechanical, but inorganic chemistry is very organized and very predictable and is sort of known to us in science as a very predictable inorganic science. Then, and DNA is an organic chemistry issue, so there's two different types of sets of science when it comes to chemistry. So this is on the organic side, but when you look at all of chemistry, you see that this pattern theory has more to do with the creator. It's more of a strong, science would prove, it's more of a strong argument to a creator than it would be to his idea, if you will, you know, like we were talking about last mm-hmm. week, because you can only mutate a few genes anyway.
Right.
But I'm just saying that that whole theory is baseless, really, when you look at inorganic to organic chemistry.
So. Yes, and that would be that. That's what I'm saying when I'm saying that his argument about it being perfect, the perfect organization, seems on its face to be contradictory. Because of the laws of science that it would have to break to go from something that was less sophisticated to more sophisticated. But the other thing is just observable science, and science prides itself on the things that can be observed using the senses. But observation would tell us that if you have something that's highly organized and that has relation and has that much commonality, that actually comes from a single source. That's my Henry Ford argument. That you would look at all those models of the early Fords while Henry Ford was alive, and you would say that came from the same person. There's commonalities there. Okay, so it wouldn't actually lend itself to just say that happened. There'd have to be a source of that. And if you find, if it organizes into the perfect family tree, then I would agree with you. That seems like it's more of a support with to say that there was a single person, capital P, that was responsible for it. So let's talk again, let's get back to orphan genes. Orphan genes are unique genes that are found in specific species or lineage with no identifiable ancestral version. Okay? So there's some genes that can be found, like way, if we go back in the fossil record, that there's no way that we can say that they have a source. Or we can trace some sort of relationship where that gene might have come from. Okay, so what are those genes? This is where I'm going to get very specific. I had to have Jamie help me with this pronunciation. Glucosaminyl transferate, and that's a typo there. Transferate 4. Okay. This is involved in humans, okay? This is a gene that helps with cell signaling and communication. So it's glycosylation, okay? Anything with that prefix has to do with sugars, okay? So and sugars help with the cell signaling and the communication between these cells. This is an orphan gene. You can't say that it came from anything else because there's no relation. Okay, there's nothing that is as specific as this gene. Chromosome 20 open reading frame 203 Okay, this has to do with human brain development, okay, which I find very interesting that it is an orphan gene, because the human brain, we would all agree, is entirely different and functions at a much higher level than any other being's brain or any other organism's brain that's on the earth. So this gene that's only found in humans, okay, it helps with human brain development. Okay? So you might be able to find, you can find genes that are not orphan genes that are shared between primates and humans. I'm listing these because they're not found in primates, they're only found in humans. Okay? Embryonic stem cell related gene, it's believed, this is only found in humans again, but it's believed that it helps in early embryonic development. And again, this in my mind goes back to the extreme how much more developed the humans are than any other primate, than any other mammal. Okay? We have these genes that are only found in humans, okay? Which means that if it's not found in primates, how could it have evolved? What's the precursor to this gene if we came from primates? It just showed up. TBC1 domain family member 3, what does this one do? This is also cell growth and signaling. Prostate and brain overexpressed 1. This is actually a gene that is expressed sometimes in certain tumors. Okay, so this gene may not always show up, but it's a gene that's only found in humans. There's no precursor, there's no relation in the rest of the natural domain. Okay. What about species that are non-human? Well, there are some pigs and other mammals that have this ZBED6 gene, this orphan gene, okay? And I don't have the function of it. Yes, here it is. It regulates muscle growth and metabolism in pigs, but it has no evolutionary history. So pigs would have to evolve from something, so why can we not find a precursor to this gene anywhere else? And it's found in some other mammals, but it's so specific, and this there's nothing that could be a precursor. There's nothing that it could have evolved from. Okay, so these orphan genes, if you would talk to a geneticist, they would really cause a lot of issues. And it's not as though there's this massive list of orphan genes, but the simple fact that they exist makes us wonder, how in the world could you have these genes that are present only here in this species? And we can't find it anywhere else if we're all related, if we all came from a common ancestor. You'd have to find the predecessor somewhere to these genes, and we can't find it. Okay, so it blows a hole in that genetic mutation issue because, again, those precursors cannot be discovered. Another problem is this information problem. Okay, the information problem, as we've alluded to earlier, is that mutations are generally harmful or neutral, and new beneficial genetic information via mutation has, and I can't stress this enough, never been observed. So you have genetic information that is inherent to an organism, and as that organism evolves, how does it evolve? It evolves through genetic mutations, which lead to different characteristics. Okay? We've listed a bunch of genes that can't have evolved from anything else because we can't find their predecessor. Now we're talking about the simple fact that even if orphan genes didn't exist, how in the world can you say that your entire premise on how humans came to be, evolution, macroevolution, is rooted upon something that's never been scientifically observed, which is a genetic mutation that leads to something beneficial? It's either going to be neutral, or more often than that, it's going to be negative. Okay? Genetic mutations are not good things. Okay? And you can say, well, okay, millions of years. Okay, we're talking about hundreds of millions of years, though. Right? Couldn't you have, over that amount of time, maybe a string of genetic mutations that would lead to a new organism? And the answer is no. There's a massive mathematical problem. Okay? So if you go from the practice of genetics to the practice of biology to the practice of mathematics, they all would say, this is a long shot. And that's an understatement. Okay? If you look at the odds, and these are observable things, if you look at the odds of a genetic mutation that is beneficial, that can be passed down, and that is usable by that organism, you can come up with a probability of that taking place. But the probability is so extremely slim that even hundreds of millions of years, you're looking at most likely you would have to age the Earth to 2 billion years. This is the waiting time problem. It's another issue. You would have to age 2 billion years based on some of these studies, and these are the scientists that I'm quoting here, forming a single new beneficial gene in a mammalian genome. It could take longer than the age of the Earth based on this study. Can you imagine 2 billion years? You're waiting 2 billion years on a single new beneficial gene. And evolutionists say that in a couple hundred million years, you went from a single-celled organism to what you are today. It just blows the mind that there are scientists who will actually tell you this, because again, this is not observed. This is just supposed based on the information that we saw on the previous slide from Richard Dawkins. He's saying based on the hierarchy, based on the genetic similarities, based on those perfect relationships, we're going to suppose that they all came from a common ancestor, even though we have a mathematic problem, we have a genetic information problem, we have all these orphan genes that we have no idea where they came from, they just popped up. Convergent evolution versus common descent. This is another major issue. Convergent evolution, this is where evolutionary traits, let's say, evolve in completely different unrelated species. The best example that I found was echolocation. It can be found in two species predominantly. Which two species are those? Janet? Bats and dolphins. Do they have a common ancestor somewhere? A bat and a dolphin both use the same echolocation when they're hunting. How fascinating, right? That both of these species just happened to evolve such a specific ability over the course of hundreds of millions of years. What are the odds that both the evolutionary pathway of a bat and the evolutionary pathway of a dolphin would result in the exact same ability? Does that stretch your brain a little bit based on everything that we've seen already of the mathematical problem and the genetic information problem? So now you're basically, you're more than doubling the odds. Okay, you're probably multiplying the odds by thousands or hundreds of thousands to say that out of all of those possible genetic mutations, these two entirely unrelated species ended up with the exact same ability. Okay, that's convergent evolution. Okay, the fossil record jumps, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. The Cambrian explosion, where you have species that are found, fossils that are found that cross the fossil record. Okay? So basically, the deeper you go, the older the fossils, except for that's not really how it works. Okay? And if you're an evolutionist, the fossil record should be the one thing that proves your point the most, right? Because the deeper you go, the simpler organisms that you find, right? Well, not really. Because these organisms, okay, with the fossil record jumps, you'll just have organisms that just appear out of nowhere. No common ancestor, okay? Are there extinct species that are found in the fossil record? Yeah, go to the dinosaur museum, right? But the issue is, how in the world could you have a species with no common ancestor just pop up in the fossil record, and as deep as you want to dig, you're not going to find its ancestor. It's just there. And you can't explain why it's there, because it shouldn't be there. It should be higher up the fossil record because it's a pretty advanced organism. Okay? So the fossil record jumps is a major, major issue. All of these, in my mind, are arguments in and of themselves that would say evolution is a stretch. Combine them together and you have some major, major issues that are to date unanswered by evolutionists. Okay, so you can bring up all of these issues and there's not going to be any cohesive argument or explanation as to how they can formulate some sort of logical thought. This slide is just going to kind of serve as a wrap-up because it's a lot of stuff that we've already talked about. But in the course of this past week when I was studying for this lesson, I came across a creationist by the name of Dr. Frank Turek. He was giving a lecture, and he only had about 15 minutes to basically give his argument for why he felt that there was a creator. And this is the memory tool that he used for those students, Surge. Okay. And again, this is going to be a review for us because we've already talked about it, but I want to use this as just kind of a final stamp on this information. Okay. So the S in Surge is the second law of thermodynamics. This is where you start at a point and then running out of energy. It's basically the degradation of everything. Okay, the best way to think about it is an explosion. Okay. At the point of the explosion, there's a massive amount of energy that's released. But then does that energy just continue? Explosion on explosion is just the same amount of energy? No, it slowly loses its energy as the explosion takes place. You can think of the largest explosion ever to take place, the Tsar Bomba, I think, by the Soviets way back in the day. That massive explosion released so much energy, but is it still exploding today? Was it still exploding a day after it was detonated? No. The second law of thermodynamics doesn't allow that to happen. The energy was used up. In our own lives, we can see the second law of thermodynamics in effect. Right? You used to be really young and energetic, like Justice, but now you're maybe not quite as energetic, right? You are aging, and things on Earth, in nature, they age. The second law of thermodynamics says that we are expending energy. Right? This is an issue, of course, with the Big Bang Theory as it's taught by modern physicists and evolutionists. The universe is expanding, that's the letter U. There was a point of creation, and now everything's expanding out from that point. And remember, before, the Big Bang Theory was the common theory as to the origination of the universe. Scientists believe that if you could prove that the universe started at a single point, it would actually prove creation. It would not prove evolutionary theory. So they've distorted that theory to say, well, actually, it proves what we were teaching all along, and it doesn't prove creation, when exactly the opposite is true. The universe is expanding. That means it was created at a single point. There was a point, location, that the universe was created. Radiation. This is the cosmic microwave background radiation. This is remnant heat from that Big Bang. Great galaxy seeds. That's kind of an interesting way to put, basically, that there's precisely tuned fluctuations. This was discovered by George Smoot. Okay, what he identified was that this cosmic microwave background radiation, there were slight fluctuations in the heat of this radiation. And because, and I am not enough of a physicist to really dive into the specifics, but because of these slight fluctuations, it leads to fluctuations in things like gravity. It leads to fluctuations in orbit. If you think of something as simple as just the tilt of the Earth's axis, its relation to the sun, all of the specific things throughout just our solar system, we're not even talking about the universe. If Jupiter was placed in a different orbit than it is, then the Earth would be subject to being just pelted with asteroids. But because Jupiter is so large and has such a gravitational pull, and it's in just the right orbit, it pulls a lot of those intergalactic projectiles away from Earth to allow for life to exist the way that it is. Okay, just the relation of the Earth to the sun, these slight variations, these seeds that created galaxies. Okay, I have a quote by George Smoot on the next slide that we're going to end with. And then lastly, the Einstein's theory of general relativity. This is the theory that time, space, and matter were all created. They all are related. Okay, so you can't have one without the other. They all had to come into being at the same time. Okay, all of those support the theory of creation as we believe it, because those what we're observing to be a support of the Big Bang is actually the support of a creation at this single point. So George Smoot, this guy that had this groundbreaking discovery of the temperature variations, this is what he said after he made his discovery. If you're religious, it's like looking at God. Essentially saying that these variations that lead to such specific relationships between objects throughout the universe, there's no conceivable way that all of those variations that lead to life as we know it on this earth could have happened without a creator. Okay. These are the types of discoveries that the scientific community is either hiding from the population or they're distorting to say that they actually prove their theories. Okay. Do not believe that. There are so many discoveries. The discovery of DNA, the scientists that discovered DNA said, that's it. There's no way at this point anyone's ever going to believe evolution because genetic information is so precise. Yet, what's the prevailing theory in the scientific community? Evolution. George Smoot, this discovery was decades ago, finding these variations in temperature. This scientist who leads the expedition is saying, it's like looking at God. And what do scientists say? Oh, proves the Big Bang. God was never a part of it at all. Right? Just the amount of deception that's taking place is so frustrating and so astounding. If you'll just dig a little bit into these theories, you will, like George Smoot, say, it's like looking at God. There is a designer. There is a creator. And everything that we know about the way that the universe works, there just can't be any other explanation because of all of these discoveries. Okay. So next Sunday is the lesson that I'm actually looking forward to the most, because we're going to transition from a lot of this scientific information to all the really cool philosophical theories. So how can, and this is where we get into the moral implications and moral arguments, apart from just the scientific, the observable, what do we know about man's heart? What do we know about actions? What do we know about man's relationship with just another man? Hey, how do humans interact with each other? How do we define right and wrong? Hey, those in and of themselves also prove that there's a creator. And I apologize that I don't have any time for questions. I'm going to have to do a quick review next week, and I will do questions at the beginning because I have so much information to get through, and then by the end, I never let you talk.